Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rombacher.
And today's topic is a pretty heady one. It is on eugenics.
Yes, yeah. That was a new word for me. Hey. I learned about it when I knew we were doing this episode.
You're learning.
Yeah. Yay, I hope you are too. No, but it sounds pretty fascinating. We're going to be hearing a lot from Joseph Miller.
Yeah.
He's a Reasons to Believe visiting scholar, and he's also a philosopher of ethics. So we're really looking forward to hearing about him and what he's kind of done in this study. And
right.
Yeah, it's going to be very good stuff.
It's a very deep topic, and it's something that is not only relevant to history, but also relevant today. So we hope that you'll stick with us and you'll learn more about eugenics.
Yeah, so what's going on in the show today? Let's talk about
yes.
the segments.
In our science-faith connection, Jeff Zwornik will be chatting with Joseph Miller about the nature of science, and they'll tie that into the topic of eugenics.
Yes, and that's going to be an extended segment this
yes.
time. So we're not doing everyday apologetics. We're
yep.
giving Jeff and Joseph some more time to hash this out.
Yeah, I'm glad that we're able to like expand that segment to hear more from Joseph on this topic and really be able to unpack some of the ideas behind science.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, first up is Culture Talk. Sandra's going to be interviewing Joseph about the contemporary problems with eugenics. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with Dr. Joe Miller. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you are the co-founder of the Center for Cultural Apologetics.
Yes.
And we're going to be talking about a topic that maybe people aren't too familiar with, but it's culturally relevant, and that is the topic of eugenics. So first, what is eugenics?
Yeah, it's a word that not a lot of people know, but a lot of the parts of it are still active today. So eugenics was a word coined by a guy named Francis Galton back in the late 1800s, late 1900s. And he was a cousin with Charles Darwin. And he sort of took Darwin's ideas and said, hey, if we take what's happening in nature, nature's kind of selecting which mm-hmm. creatures are more fit to survive, and we sort of put science to this, could we help advance the evolution of society, of humans, through taking direct scientific action. So at its core, it's that idea, and it just sort of means good breeding. How do we breed better human beings?
Yeah, so it's like a human ordained, I guess, evolution?
Yeah, yeah. So eugenics, you can look at, there's really two classical kind of groups. There's positive eugenics, mm-hmm. which is people saying, hey, I make good choices about who I'm going to marry, because mm-hmm. I want them to be biologically compatible or right. produce really tall people or whatever your goal would be. Healthy, if you don't want to marry somebody who's not healthy. So that's mm-hmm. sort of called positive because you choose to do those things.
Right.
Negative eugenics was forced things like forced sterilizations because, oh, this group of people is sick and they don't want them to pass on their genes, so the government would force them to be sterilized against their will. And then there's sort of what I would call natural eugenics, just sort of the way nature operates was the idea within that Darwin's framework of the purely natural material world. Fitter stuff survives, less fit stuff dies.
Right. So I think people might be familiar with the negative eugenics, which was something that was a part of World War II.
Yes.
But also even modern day negative eugenics with sterilizing women.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's something that people are probably familiar with. How do we see it play, like what are some other specific roles that eugenics plays in our current cultural climate?
Yeah, you're right to point out, with Hitler and the eugenic thing, man, once that really came out, even the people that were pro-eugenists mm-hmm. said like, okay, that's something we can't
get behind,
yeah.
yeah.
Or at least not publicly, because mm-hmm. privately what they said is we need to kind of have the softer, gentler way of promoting good breeding.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a transition in the literature in the 60s that really talked about people choosing, we want to convince people it's their choice to live this lifestyle, it's mm-hmm. their choice to be good breeders in their decision-making process. Mm-hmm. And so you see there's an effort to convince people to participate in these eugenic type goals for their mm-hmm. life.
So how do we see that eugenics play a role specifically as it relates to AI?
Yeah. Well, AI is, artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. which most people are familiar with.
Yeah.
And there's a couple levels of AI.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about, on my Tesla, that my car can drive and stay within the lines, that's a form of artificial intelligence mm-hmm. that's just basic decision making of, you know, keeping it the car within the lanes, right? But then there's more advanced artificial intelligence, which is the idea of, can we replicate human consciousness, or even someday put our consciousness inside of an artificial computer system? And so there's a whole spectrum of what we mean by that, you know, depending on who's doing the studies there, from the car to replacing humanity.
Right. Yeah. And so that becomes then this kind of predicament that we need to grapple with. So from a Christian perspective, how would you respond to such a predicament?
Yeah, I think the part to be careful of for Christians is, okay, it's one thing if my car can stay in the lines.
Right.
It's another thing if we're saying, hey, we can build a better human, which is essentially a eugenic idea, right? So, well, what happens when we maybe equip certain humans to have certain skills or capacities because they have technology integrated? You see this in sci-fi movies, right? If you're a sci-fi movie fan, you love this sort of thing, like somebody's got super arms or their mind works in a great way. Well, is there potential that the wealthy will be able to get access to this and then the poor will be left behind? Or will we start to value some humans more than others because they're artificially enhanced? And again, I think it's where, even as a Christian watching sci-fi films, this plays out all the time, and it does because we see it historically played out that way in the old eugenics fashion. And so there's no reason to think humans will be much different today and acting on those compulsions.
Right. And so then for those who have a Christian perspective, how do they kind of engage in conversations when talking about AI and kind of the excitement of it, the potential of it, but also some deep concerns specifically as it relates to humans and how humans are valued?
Yeah. I think one of the things they could do is an easy sort of bellwether is to look at and say, okay, whatever kind of AI you're talking about, however you want to define it, you know, instead of getting caught in the nitty-gritty, which most people aren't aware of, just say, look, ask people, is this going to be something that is going to benefit everybody or only a segment of people? And if it's always going to be restricted to some sort of tribalistic group, you know, oh, it's only for these politically connected people, it's only for the wealthy, it's only for this, you know, racial group, or it's only for this man, or if it's only for women, or however it is, if it starts to become tribalistic technology, where some humans are excluded, then that's where I think we have to start saying, okay, little red flags have to come up, because that's not valuing the sacredness of every human being if that technology becomes exclusive to one group or another.
So let's talk very briefly then about kind of that sacredness, a basic understanding of where we get our sacredness from and how that would be communicated to someone maybe who's skeptical and saying, no, let's not stop advances in science. Let's go for it. Like, how would you have that conversation and kind of show the basis for human sacredness?
Yeah. So if anybody reads, like, anybody who talks about this issue, especially from a secular perspective, it's always based on the idea of human dignity and human rights. But read enough in that stuff, and most people admit, those are all pretty squishy words.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of concrete meaning. What what you think is somebody who deserves dignity or rights is different than somebody else. So how do you decide? Well, the scripture gives us a better playing field to have that. In Genesis 1:27, I even get to wear the shirt, Betzalem Elohim, it's Genesis 1:27. It just means in the image of God. And so this idea that all of us are created as sacred beings in the image of God, regardless of our social status, if we're the in crowd or the out crowd, financial status, rich or poor, regardless of whatever social constructs people create to segregate us, we're all sacred. And if we start with that beginning place, not on discussions of rights, not on discussions of like human dignity, but on the actual of our base nature that is sacred, regardless of whether we're handicapped or fully abled, whatever the terms are, then I think we're gonna end up talking about a better path forward.
Right. Thank you. If you would like more on this topic, go to morethancake.org and you'll find Joe Miller's blogs there.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome to 2819, a show where we explore important scientific issues, how they relate to the truth of Christianity, and how we can use them to share the gospel. I'm excited today because I'm joined by Dr. Joe Miller, and we're going to be talking about science and some of the peril and promise that it brings. Joe, it's good to have you here today.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I'm glad to join the show.
So why don't you give us a little bit of background on who you are and why you and I are talking here today about science?
Yeah, well, I guess I've spent enough time and money on education that it kind of made me worth being showing up here. I started my my academic career, I guess, in college at Penn State, studied engineering, went on from there. I got multiple degrees in theology and philosophy at the master's level. Did a DMin at Biola a bunch of years, mostly on leadership and theology, but then ended up most recently finishing a PhD, working on a PhD in ethics.
Okay.
And so that sort of led to a lot of mix of science and philosophy and theology, especially as they pertain to a lot of issues of human sacredness and the value of human life.
There's an aspect to science that is, I think people have maybe had a little bit of their confidence in the integrity of science shaken, in part because of all of the COVID stuff. It seems like science is politicized. It seems like science is saying this and then this and then this. And just kind of how would you assess what's gone on in terms of how people look at science and how should they look at science?
Yeah, I think the conflict ultimately comes down to not with science itself or the methodologies, because it's not just one methodology. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's many methodologies. Or the practice of science. I think it's just we've had a mistaken understanding about what science really accomplishes for us. In other words, a lot of people have this sense that if it's science says it, then it's this absolute, immovable, you know, truth that can never change. But science itself is, you know, truth is limited. It's corrigible. You know, it's changeable. Because you discover something, there's some partial knowledge, and then future discoveries can say, oh, well, we have to modify that old thing. And so it's always a process of give and take and exchange with science. But when people have the perception that science says as if there's some monolithic one answer to everything, then when you get into a situation like COVID where there's competing studies and information, we think, oh, well, science is broken, or all these sort of things happen. But it's not really science that's broken. One, it's our perception of science, but it's two, what people try to do with it and the political side to use it to their advantage that deform really the value of what science promises to give us.
Well, you made a comment in there that science isn't kind of done and established and monolithic or whatever, but how would you respond to the claim that I've heard often among Christians is that, well, we shouldn't put any credibility in science because science is just always changing. So there's the one side that it's monolithic, but then there's this other side of what does it really bring that contributes?
Obviously there's always the pendulum swings to these extreme views. And there are some Christians, sadly, historically, that just sort of say, oh, well, science is so unreliable because it can change. And we used to think, certain chemicals were good. And then we realized those are bad. We used to put certain things in our buildings. We realized, oh, that causes cancer. And we changed those things. So, yes, there are those things that happen. But science overall has allowed us to progress society, to help humans, to help survival, to bring health to people. So there's many things and benefits that it's brought us, even though it's always a limited, the knowledge itself has its limits, right? Because we can have new discoveries that lead us to new findings. But in terms of the short term and in terms of where we're at, there are many valuable tools and, you know, practices and approaches to life that it gives us that really enhance human life.
Well, I mean, I don't know that the truth is the right term to use there, but it does seem like science has a capacity to show us, hey, this is what's going on. So when you do an experiment, there's a fact about that, you know, that there's something that's happened. I mean, you know, how you explain that, I mean, the more encompassing you try and get your explanation, obviously it gets more detailed and complicated.
Yeah.
But I do see science as a pursuit of the truth. Would you agree with that, or how would you interact with that statement?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I've heard people frame it differently, and some of it just helps us to make sure we're thinking of it rightly. I know there's some philosophers and scientists say science is never the exploration of truth, it's the exploration of knowledge. And now, you know, some others would have that problem making that distinction. But I think
are truth and knowledge two separate things?
Yeah,
honest question.
That's what I'm saying. Some would take issue with that.
Okay.
I guess I would frame it like this, is that the idea of truth and reality, those things are stable, especially if we talk about a transcendent truth of God or the nature of the world that he created. But there are some aspects of truth that are corrigible. They can change over time. And it doesn't make them not true. In other words, I could tell you today that I'm allergic to peanut butter. They could come up with a, you know, a vaccine or a medicine mm-hmm. that I could do it, and then tomorrow I would not be. That didn't make it untrue when I said it. It just means that the state of circumstances has changed, and there's a new truth statement about my how my body reacts to peanut butter, right? So
it's almost like there's some things that have a context around them, where some things tend to be a little more, some things have a bigger context, some things have a smaller context.
So I think it's the idea that science tells us something, gives us knowledge about the world, and that knowledge is valid, but we always have to hold on to it a little bit lightly, recognizing that with new discovery or new observations and maybe improved technology, we can find new ways of understanding that truth. That give us a fuller picture of what it involves. Because even as Christians, we have to say, like, we know God, we say we know God, or we know the truth of the Bible. But even as Paul says, you know, we've seen a mirror darkly lit. You know, there's not a fullness to that, because there's an infinite God who knows way more than we do. And so we only know part of that truth that's God. That doesn't make it untrue, what we know. It just means that it's partial. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the same with science. So just like our theology can be partial, but that doesn't make it untrue. Science can be partial, but not untrue. So we have to be careful with that. It's when we try to make science an absolute thing of, it tells us some absolute unchangeable truth, that we get into trouble.
Are there worldview issues that come into the truth of science?
Yeah, well, I think all scientific knowledge is contingent knowledge. In other words, it's contingent on the state of the nature of the world we live in. Mm-hmm. So nature itself can change. Things can happen that change the state of our environment, of the world we live in. Science tells us, gives us good knowledge, good information about our world. But we always have to recognize that it's always limited based on our perceptions and based on our experience and based on what we can experiment on. Otherwise, then we get into theoretical physics, right? Which
right.
is way outside of what we can experiment on. It's making speculation with certain set of assumptions about, well, if these 10 factors hold mm-hmm. true, then therefore this must be true in these scenarios. But we can't really always observe those particular set of factors.
So one of the things that came up in the midst of the pandemic, and I think, you know, part of why science has taken a hit in terms of people's trust, is that they've actually seen the internal workings of how science has always operated. If I were an outsider, I would say, oh, science is this kind of objective process done by objective, rational people, and it never has been.
It's true.
But given enough time, science has come to objective conclusions on a lot of things. We just saw all the messy stuff play out. But one of the things that's true is, you know, follow the science, and generally this is what the consensus is. I kind of want to explore how do we, you know, if science is, you know, always subjective, that we might learn something new in the future. There's this consensus view. How do we deal with the consensus, or what do we do with that? Is that just something we say, hey, the consensus is the way to go?
Well, you know, a lot of times that's all we have to operate with at the moment. Like you said, we're pretty early on in, say the COVID thing. So a lot of times when you're looking back at history, you think, oh, we've always thought, you know, this was good or that was bad. But if you live through those times, you realize everybody went through a process of doubting, well, is that good or bad? I mean, the phrase I've read, you know, mad as a hatter, right?
right.
Where does it come from? Well, at some point they said, hey, it's good. We could use this certain chemical and it makes these really awesome hats. Well, eventually people realized when they used this chemical, it made people insane.
Yeah.
So they said, okay, that's not a good thing to use. So
there's not too many chemicals I've seen my dad particularly sensitive to, and that one, that's one of them.
Yeah.
Just for that reason.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of things that can cause us, you know, to change and shift what the consensus is.
Yeah. It seems like there's this claim almost made that science is kind of the ultimate arbiter of what's true, what's not, and even what's good and what's bad. But it seems like that can't be a complete picture.
No, it's not, because science is always interpreted through a worldview framework. So the people that are doing the experiments get to decide what experiments to run. They get to decide what theories to test. They get to decide what evidence counts and what evidence is discounted. And all that ends up being in papers, and they're supposed to be peer review. But if everybody doing the peer review agrees, you're not getting opposing views and ideas to say, well, wait a minute, what about testing it this way? There is no such thing as science says. Scientists say things, but science never says anything because science is a tool that we use. That's like saying, you know, you're a construction worker. You say, well, my hammer says. It's like, no, you're the one that's doing the work. You're the one doing the construction. You're building, and you are controlling that hammer. So we as humans control the science methodologies we use. We can control the money, where we put the money based on priorities, and often those are political. Some of the times they're religious. There's a lot of factors in influencing what we value in doing the process of science. So yeah, we have to be cautious that that our worldview allows for dissent in science. So when we were seeing articles about COVID stuff, oh, you can't have that. That's not what science tells us. That's really unhealthy for science. Mm-hmm. It's great for politicians who like power and control, but it's bad for the process of science because history tells us we need those dissenting voices, even if only to the point that they help us confirm maybe what the consensus is. But sometimes they tell us the consensus is wrong. And so, but how do we know unless we weigh those options?
So give an example of a place where the consensus was broad, but now we know it to be wrong.
Well, okay, so here's a non-political one, right? Here's one that I think people can say, oh, okay, this, we're taking it out of our current political context. Mm-hmm. So you get Louis Pasteur, right? He's had this idea that, oh, well, germs can spread disease. And the consensus was, you're insane, that's nuts. No one believes that. Mm-hmm. There's no consensus there. And so eventually enough push and energy came and they said, oh, eventually the new consensus was, yeah, germs cause problems. We need to do things like pasteurize milk because that will help us prevent disease from, you know, getting into people's lives and hurting people. Okay, so there is a consensus that Pasteur was a nut. And then eventually everyone said, oh, well, we always knew this was true. You know, it's this idea that we never denied that, of course. So that's on a sort of, you know, a politically neutral thing. But there was always different consensus about things like race, you know, which we've explored, like things like scientific racism and other issues, where the consensus was, you know, certain racial groups were inferior, lower on the scale of evolution. Poverty, it was once thought, was actually a genetic biological condition. So if you were poor, there's a reason why social programs try to make poor people live in certain areas, because that way they couldn't interbreed with the wealthy people and pass on their genetic defect of poverty. Those were consensus ideas at one point, but somebody had to push against those to say, that's not right.
You know, as I'm sitting there listening, kind of implicit in this whole idea is that there is some objective standard out there which we need to measure against. So, I mean, you know, as a scientist, I can come along and propose whatever idea I want. I could get every scientist to agree that my idea is great. But ultimately, if we go out and make some sort of test of that idea in the real world that doesn't line up, either I have to say, well, I'm just wrong, or at the very minimum, I have to go and say, okay, I need to modify this because this data says this model's not correct. So there is this objective thing that we're measuring against
that's
that we don't get to say, hey, I just like it to be this way.
Yeah, in philosophy, there's this idea, what's called the correspondence theory of truth. That is, what is true is defined by anything that corresponds to reality. You know, it's a simple definition, right? But not everyone agrees with that. But it's say, hey, whatever is true is because it corresponds to reality. In other words, there has to be something outside of my experience as a scientist or your experience as just as a human that says that there's a reality out there that I can, what I'm saying matches.
Well, thanks, Joe. I really do appreciate your comments. You know, if you found our discussion today, I would encourage you to go check out Joe's blog. It's called morethancake.org. It's got some great articles about the nature of science and how it works, how scientific consensus of eugenics was there and how that played out. Some great resources to see how science works and One of the things that I just find fascinating and encouraging and excited about this is that there is this objective reality that we can go out and pursue and figure out what it has to say, how this world behaves. Now, we do realize there are worldview issues that play into that, but Christianity is one of those worldviews out there saying, hey, this is the way the world works. This is the way things operate. And we can go test and see whether that's true. And to the extent it conforms to reality or matches reality, we can be confident that it is true. And my conviction is, as you go out and explore that reality, you will become more convinced of Christianity and be excited about telling others about that.
That does it for us this week on 2819. I certainly learned a lot, hoping all you did too. Sandra, what'd you learn?
You know, the idea of eugenics, I think it's really an important topic to be familiar with, especially as technology continues to advance. And like Joseph was talking about, you know, these technologies can then become limited as far as access to marginalized groups. So we have to think about kind of our moral obligations with regard to new technologies and stuff. But then also, I think the conversation that Jeff had with Joseph, talking about what science is, what it isn't, then it kind of like where biases come into play. So
yeah.
I think all of those were really, really important topics.
And I mean, I'm just going to say, like, everything Joseph said was just fascinating to me. We need to get him back.
Yeah, no, for sure. And he has cool shirts, too.
Yes, so. And I like flat caps.
Yeah.
So, yeah, looks good. But yeah, back to eugenics, though. I love what he was saying about tribalistic technology and the biases with that. And that's something really deep and heavy that we have to think about. We can't just move forward with technology, but really have to think about, who is this benefiting?
Right.
And with that, I love that he got into the difference between people saying science says this as compared to scientists say this.
Right.
So it's very good stuff. I think that's actually a good starting point if you're interested in any of the STEM fields, that you have to understand that concept.
Right. No, for sure. I think it's helpful because sometimes then we lock science into this box and say it has to remain this. But you know, scientists continue to learn more, and so there has to be space for adjustments as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I think one of the takeaways is philosophy and ethics is important.
Right?
Yay. Yeah, Yay. Not just about science. Let's learn some other things there.
Well, we hope that you learned with us as well about this really deep topic of eugenics and really the nature of science. And also, we hope that this episode has helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And make sure you subscribe, like our pages. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show. Share your thoughts about this episode, what you think about science, the nature of science, eugenics, and let us know if there's other topics and themes that you want us to cover.
For sure, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And then also, if you want the audio version only, let's say you're on the go, you're in the car, you're commuting, you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. Search for Reasons to Believe Podcasts.
See you all next time.
Bye.